Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And I have received a number of phone calls and questions since LA went up in flames regards insurance. And I noticed that a lot of people are talking about it. A lot of people are worried about it. And I thought we'd do a program today on what I know about insuring personal possessions. And I also, I'm joined by Gina Dillon, longtime colleague of mine in the art restoration business. She works for Fine Art Conservatory Laboratories, Conservation Laboratories, I should say, here in town in Goleta. And she has been with the company for a while now and been through thick and thin with them. So I thought I would, and she's also a disaster coordinator for the company. So I thought I would ask her to opine on a couple of points. Especially, I've been sort of writing, Gina, a list of phone calls, questions that have come into our office about, you know, insurance and what people should be thinking about regards personal property. So I've got that list too, and I want to refer to that as we go forward. But first of all, I want to introduce Gina. So Gina is a California native. She was born to artistic parents. They were in the media world. She began her artistic journey at the Fleischer Institute in Philadelphia. She was 7 years old, but she didn't decide to go forward with an art career. She returned to California at 19, and her career took off in the world of TV, and she was in broadcast TV for a number of decades. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. And Scott Haskins, her boss, is a good friend of mine. He actually said, you know, Gina would be great on the program because she knows so much about what we do in disasters. However, she also would be great on the program because she comes from a broadcast career. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's wild. So, well, thank you for having us on today and for having me. Yeah. You know, my mom worked for NBC. And my dad was also in radio. My brother ended up in television. My sister ended up in radio. And I ended up in television. And it was it was a lot of fun, you know. It was definitely, it was definitely a journey, you know, working in dark control rooms. Going out in the field and shooting live events and covering, even in 1993, working at KEYT, you know, we were covering those fires in the mountains up there. And I was just doing it from a control room. I was a technical director. So I basically, you know, would have be the one who worked with the director and pushed all the buttons and made everything happen. Sorry, I'm turning off my phone. We're getting so many calls right now from, you know, here's it is another fire 30 years later, you know, 32 years later, the fires continue. But yeah, I worked in television. It was just a lot of fun. And I ended up, you know, floating out to Denver, Colorado, worked for KUSA, ended up starting with the DirecTV Uplink Center when they first launched. So I worked at the Satellite Uplink Center in master control and so on and so forth. And then around 98, those jobs started to become obsolete. So there was just no more work in that field because they had computers that did everything. So ended up back in California and back in Ojai, trying to figure out what's next. So
okay, and then you lost your home in the Thomas Fire in 2007.
Yeah, exactly. Was renting a place in the east end of Ojai. And I remember the night that this all started to go down in 2017. You could see looking towards Santa Paula and Upper Ojai, just this orange glow. And there was just so much fear and the electricity went out and we were all, you know, waiting for gas stations to open because the pumps weren't working without electricity. So then as soon as the pumps were open, we were evacuating. It was about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. We ended up in Carpinteria at a Motel 6. There was a whole caravan of us who knew each other from Ojai because it's such a small community anyway. We ended up at a Motel 6, got all our animals into the Motel 6. It was probably around midnight or 2 in the morning. The fire crews came through and evacuated everybody out of Carpinteria, out of the Motel 6. And now we're all in our cars with our animals running up and downstairs and, you know, getting into cars and driving north. That lasted a month. So it was pretty insane. And so, yeah, I came back and the place I was renting was just destroyed. And, you know, all of my things that were in storage were destroyed and all that kind of stuff. And I moved to Ventura, and that's, I was also working in Ojai, and the places where I was working were destroyed. So I ended up moving to Ventura and looking for another office manager job. And that's how I met Scott. It was May 2nd, 2018 at 12 noon. I remember. Yeah.
And so I just want to say the Fine Art Conservation Laboratory in Goleta, Scott is a master of art restoration, mural restoration, all sorts of restorations. And right now, when I spoke to him last, he was in the burn zone in the Palisades, consulting with clients regards, you know, some of the priceless art that was either damaged or lost there. I also want to say to Gina, it's been an interesting time here, because what happens is what you just talked about is we experience these things with our fellow Californians, and we remember here in Santa Barbara all the anniversaries of all the fires that we've been through.
Right.
And so it brings up all kinds of memories. And, you know, I was thinking about this with my longtime office manager. I have an office on the East Coast, and Sean is my office manager on the East Coast. Sean, for the Jesusita fire, I needed his help in Santa Barbara with the big project we were doing. So I flew him into Santa Barbara on the night the fire was exploding here in Santa Barbara. I didn't realize that, you know, that was when he was coming in. His ticket was booked months in advance.
Which fire was this?
The Jesusita fire.
Okay.
And so Sean was flying in, and you know, he was seeing the fire from above because he was flying over the fire.
Right.
When he landed, I went to pick him up, and I said, Sean, you know, we've been evacuated from my house, which was on sort of the Nolita area. And so we've been evacuated. So, you know, and Sean said, well, I've got a hotel room. And I think it was at the Lemon Tree or something like that on State Street. And I said, well, I'm going to have to stay with you. Well, Sean's a gay man. He wasn't all that thrilled with the idea that I was going to stay in the same hotel room, let alone the same bed. And of course, I had my dog. And so then as checking into the hotel was evacuated.
Oh, my gosh.
So, so you know, that I had the same story as you. We were frantically trying to find, you know, two rooms. In the end, we couldn't find two rooms. We had one room. And I remember Sean being sort of petrified, laying in bed with me for an entire night. He didn't like that much.
Scary, but for sure. Rate,
it brings up memories, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, for sure. And so, we've had a lot of calls as well, you know, over this fire. And it's interesting because when the fires were blazing down, you know, Palisades, Malibu, Eaton fire, now there's been like the Clarita, Camarillo, you know, people have been calling us from Montecito and rushing their artwork over to us for safekeeping just because they're so terrified and they have so much PTSD over the losses from, you know, those last times that it came through followed by mudslides. It was just absolutely horrendous time for everyone. And, you know, so we've already gotten a few calls and are storing a bunch of art, but for all those folks down in Palisades, you know, Malibu, the houses that are incinerated to the ground. I mean, it's really heartbreaking to lose that much art, especially for our business. You know, while on one hand, business is booming, on the other hand, we're losing precious heirlooms that, you know, we have committed to saving, you know, and now they're gone, just completely gone. So
So I'm going to start us off by asking a question of you and see what you would advise me to talk about. So one of the questions that came into our office, Gina, was a friend of mine called me when her friend's house was in the Palisades was still on fire. And this friend had called my friend and said, you know, what shall I be doing? It looks like most of my art collection is gone. And so this was, you know, complicated because he did not have, he had homeowner's insurance, but he didn't have a rider or a scheduled coverage for the art. So just to give you a little background. So he thought that he had insurance on his art to the tune of about 60 grand, which was in his bucket. So that's his blanket coverage. So that means all of the art in his expensive, you know, high net worth home came to an aggregate of 60 grand and over which he would have had to have rider coverage to have the rest of the collection insured, which he did not. So he had only blanket coverage for 60 grand, which sounds like a lot, but it wasn't in his case. So he had fine art coverage. He had fine art coverage through his homeowner's policy, blanket coverage, which blanket coverage, you usually in a homeowner's policy, you have blanket coverage for silver, for sometimes collectibles, for sometimes fine art, for sometimes depreciable furniture and appreciable furniture. So they're different pockets. They assign a certain figure. And it's based on, you're with me so far. So he was saying, you know, I know that I can claim that 60 grand, but the issue is I've got pieces beyond which, and as a matter of fact, my friend that was talking to me is a dealer and knew his collection because she just recently sold this gentleman a $30,000 painting.
Right.
So she knew that he had way more than what the bucket coverage was, that blanket coverage of 60 grand.
Right.
She knew that he had much more, but he didn't request of his insurance company a separate fine art rider coverage. Mm-hmm. And he would have needed an appraisal to make that request.
Right.
Because obviously, you know, they needed to have it scheduled. Now the artwork is gone. And my friend, my girlfriend was saying, okay, should we hire you now? And, you know, the same question would be for you and a little bit different spin on it. So before the insurance company hires an adjuster to look into his situation, which they will, and should he hire you guys now to preempt what the adjuster might say? Because the adjuster is not a conservator. Adjuster is an adjuster. Doesn't have the background that your company does. So what would you say to that?
Well, I would say going backwards in time, just to reiterate that you definitely, if you have an art collection, you know, you've bought a piece from a gallery for, you know, 30 grand, or you've got, you know, $1 million worth of artwork in your possession at the time of the fire. The only thing that I can really point out that starts to become a problem is when people don't have an inventory because they don't track all the things that they bought. They don't keep track of their receipts. They haven't had previous appraisals. You know, you need to keep your art collection in check. You need to, just like we do at our laboratory, we have to know where every piece of art is at every time. And we, you know, have spreadsheets and databases and whatever. We kind of have to have the same thing when you are serious about art. Once it's gone, it's gone. You know, the insurance company may or may not pay you what the value of those items were. And of course, it is always different. All these insurance companies and all these policies are completely different. But if you have an inventory and you keep records, that's going to be your best friend.
I agree with you totally. And I often say that the best mitigation is not necessarily to hire your firm or my firm. Although it is very wise, prudent thing to do is, you know, have an expert look at
So then that's the next, that's the next thing. I mean, once the disaster has occurred, whether it's fire or flood or just exposure to smoke or whatever, it is a good idea to obviously document anything that you can see in the home, the before and afters. Just like any disaster, you're supposed to take video of your home and all of the items around your house. That means opening and closing drawers and things like that. But you want to make sure you go in and document after the fire as well, you know, doing those repeat photography or videos. And having us out in the field, yes, that's great to bring us in so we can help you salvage what is left. Even pulling those items out of the house and then writing up, you know, an estimate for restoration on those items. But we don't get involved with the price. We won't know if a painting is worth $1,000 or $10,000 or if it was grandmother's painting. To us, the value of the painting doesn't matter until the cost of restoration exceeds the value of that painting. So if you bring us a painting that you paid $2,000 for in a local market, you have receipts for it, you have it inventoried and everything like that, and we come to you and we say, well, to repair this painting, it's going to cost you $3,500. Well, obviously the insurance company is not going to do anything about it. And in 7 years that I've been working with insurance companies, it's all over the place. It is different every single day. Everybody's situation is completely different. I mean, I have stories upon stories. I've actually walked through rubble myself. I was out at the Pear Blossom Highway fire a few years back, and I went out there with one of our technicians, and we had to get into the house that was literally rubble, black charred rubble, and sift through things with masks on, of course, and get those paintings out of there, loaded into the van and driven back to, you know, our laboratory. And, you know, in his situation, he had all the documentation on all these paintings, and we submitted a proposal for cleaning, and it was accepted by the insurance. And I think the insurance companies, for us in particular, are very pleased with our competitive rates, because I've even been told by other restoration companies that our numbers are low or lower than others, but we're not there to milk it. We're there to help people with their art and then get the work, you know, because we have lives to sustain. We have families, you know, and we're in this business to save art. So we do the best that we can to make the adjusters and the homeowners and the insurance companies happy so that it's a smooth process and we can get things done. I don't really recall any times where an insurance company has ever said your bid is too high, except for the fact when, you know, it's a bunch of art that is not, you know,
it's not worth the restoration because it doesn't pan out. I get it. And So here's a little known fact. A lot of people may not know this, but Regina brings up a point that makes me think of something. So let's say a painting is worth $2,000, or let's say an antique piece of furniture, because our office does all kinds of valuables. So let's say we've got a piece of furniture and it's worth $2,000. And now half of it's been really compromised by the smoke damage and by the water damage that goes along with the fire. Water damage is really quite significant usually after a fire. And so what we have now is we've got sort of a semi. Now I take this to a conservator of fine furniture, let's say it's 18th century piece. And he says to me, well, you know, the restoration of this piece and the rebuild of the bottom half is going to cost $2,500. Well, the piece is worth fair market value $2,000. So the insurance company says, oh, well, you know, that's a total loss. We're going to buy it.
Yeah.
And they buy it. And you, that's it. It's gone. So
yeah, they have us destroy things. I got a call from an insurance company. There were some paintings that came into the lab. They were claiming a loss. I can't remember. I think they were damaged in shipping. They were claiming a loss. but they were also claiming this is the insured, that the painting was an original. Well, it was found, they brought these paintings to our lab and they were found to be fake. And so the insurance company basically did this exactly what you just said. They said, you know, this is a total loss. We're buying them from you. So the insurer just took whatever whatever money they got. And then I think it was Farmers or State Farm, they called us and said, destroy the painting. There were three of them. Destroy them. They're fakes. We don't want them. They can't be back out on the market. You don't want them showing up. You know, we could be totally liable, you know, for a painting that was given to someone and they thought that they could go out and sell it and push off this fake. It would just come back to us. So yeah, we have a lot of integrity. We have to follow the rules when it comes to insurance companies. But for the most part, it's been pretty easy working with insurance companies. Getting payments and so on and so forth isn't too painful. It comes, you know. And we are.
Well, I think that's remarkable. That I wish I could say the same from my end. Basically, with the changing market with insurance and as far as personal possessions, I mean, I have done, Gina, I have done the last 3-4 years. Majority of my business is in with law firms who are suing SD&E or PPG. They're suing the utility companies on behalf of their clients because the utility companies have a trust fund from which they'll pay, whatever is above what the client can derive from homeowners insurance up to a point. And they give us a really, really difficult argument as to why things are not as valuable as perhaps an appraisal will
oh,
will
attest that is to. True. That
you
is
know,
true.
So I want to talk when we get back from the break. There's a couple of things that are so easy, and you referenced one of them. Clients that are listening, friends that are listening, do what Gina says and make an inventory. There's even good software out there. I mean, even your phone's got a kind of an inventory system app that you can purchase. Make an inventory of the valuables in your home. When I say valuables, Gina, there's a legal definition for valuables that we use in tort proceedings, as an expert witness with some of these fire issues. Valuable can be important by virtue of the dollar figure. Important can also mean something that is part of your own personal narrative, part of your own personal story that has emotional resonance.
Wow.
So important can be emotion. That's only in legal proceedings. That has nothing to do with insurance because insurance doesn't recognize that.
They don't recognize.
No.
No.
But that when you're doing an inventory, that may matter to you, importance based on family story, narrative story, personal connections. That really may matter to you for the sake of a loss like this, because in various court proceedings, it does matter. So what you want to do is make that inventory, make notes of things that that are valuable by virtue of the dollar figure, but also by virtue of the connection to you and your family. That's really an important fact. People leave that out in a cold, hard inventory, but it can matter if you are in a court proceeding, for example, and you're testing against a utility company, which is basically where a lot of the action has been in the Camp Fire and the Malibu Fire and our fire. So when we talk about this inventory, it could be written. It could be also written and could be two things more. One would be a video of you walking around your house saying, this is this, this is that, this is, Uncle so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. It could be that. It could be a video, which I encourage. But it also should be still photos. Why? Because when I'm in court and I'm talking about a loss and all I have is a room shot of Christmas celebration in somebody's house in Paradise, California.
Yeah.
If I have that room shot, I can really zoom in on it and I can see all kinds of details that I wouldn't necessarily be able to see with the video.
Yeah.
What you're trying to do is establish ownership, which is, if it's in your house and you're narrating it, that established ownership. That establishes ownership for sure. So you've got to prove ownership, and you have to prove also, you have to prove ownership. You have to prove where this happened. And ownership and location are the two most important things that you've got to document. I would say with video and still images as well. Also, right. What Gina's saying, a written inventory too would be important.
I mean, you could use an Excel spreadsheet, but yeah. It seems to me that, you know, a lot of these items that are in the homes that are heirlooms, that are irreplaceable, hold a lot. That's where all the emotional value comes in. And documenting, this painting was done by my grandmother when she was 17, you know, in 1932, you know, those kinds of things are important too, if it gets to the litigation.
Right.
But with fire, you know, fire's coming. Nobody necessarily knows which direction it's going to go, but you know, there's a danger. You should have had this inventory done long before. Do it now, do it today. Don't hesitate. Don't put it off, because it's always when it's too late, you know, that's where we have the most regret. And
yes. I also, when we get back from the break, I want to discuss a little bit how emotional value is assessed.
Yeah.
How emotional value gets turned into monetary value. It's fascinating. Yeah. How these utility companies figure this and their attorneys figure it, and why it matters, as Gina was saying, it matters to actually make that inventory and make notes of why this matters to you. And also, Gina, is important. Let's say now this is all for insurance purposes we're talking about, and loss purposes, two separate buckets we're talking about. But it's also very valuable for your heirs to have.
Yeah.
A record like this, you know, so that's another thing. Now that would go to something like if you're writing your estate, your trust.
Yeah.
This sort of inventory would be important. Okay, Richard, let's go to quick break. When we get back from the break, I want to also ask Gina what her office recommends as easy to do, prescient, safe practices, best practices. I mean, Scott once told me we were in a house. Your boss, we were in a house together, and he said, I just cannot believe this stuff. I see it all the time. People store art on the closet floor. In a flood situation, that's the first point. And he's nobody thinks of that. At least raise the art up, because you know, the water damage, nobody thinks of that. And we witnessed the exact same thing at the same time. We opened a closet and there was a number of works on paper, valuable works on paper, on the floor, standing up on the floor, you know. And Scott said, you see that? That happens all the time. People don't think about raising the art up. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Sad.
Okay. Let's go to quick break. We get back from the break, we'll talk a little bit more with Gina Dillon. And it's really cool to see Gina. By the way, she is in New Orleans right now. And I want to ask her about the snow. In a minute, too.
Okay.
Okay, go turn that down. Back in a minute.
Okay.
Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Gina Dillon. Gina has been a business administrator for Fine Art Conservation Laboratories, I think, since, is it 2018, Gina? When did you join the lab?
I started in 2018 in May, And we were in a little lab down on Felinda Avenue, down in Santa Barbara, on the west, at the west side. And I just walked in and I was kind of blown away. You know, I'm just looking at all of this interesting art all over and easels and lying on hot tables and, you know, met Scott and really had no idea what art conservation was. I don't know why I never thought of it. I just always think of myself as painting and having fun with art, but I never thought about fixing it. But of course, it's been going on for centuries. So I met Scott and it was so interesting to me and so fun. And of course, he hired me on the spot. So we started in. And then that's right as the fires were kind of wrapping up from the Thomas fires. And then our work really began. And that was, you know, helping all these people between that and the mudslides, you know, restore their family heirlooms and their priceless art and everything like that. Yeah. So it's been so a wild ride, 7 years.
Okay, so you found that basically a through line in your career, because it sounds like to me that you're a very visual person.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I've been an office manager for film company, for natural products company, you know, a PR agent, you know, things like that. Just kind of jumping around. Of course, had to make my way through the recession as well. You know, like everybody else, and had a small boy and everything. So he's a grown man now and also works with Scott on murals and restoring, murals. It's just been a very interesting and never boring, type of job. The weeks are just flying. There's just so much to do in a given day. I've been getting calls left and right from down south, you know, on these fires. And this one gal, and it's just constant between texting and calling and emailing these people who are trying to even navigate what's going on in their own neighborhood, you know, calling us and asking us if they're allowed to go into the Palisades area with an escort and who needs what ID. I mean, it sounds to me like it's a military zone down there.
Oh, it's yeah.
And so, you know, they're calling us and asking us, well, can we do this? Can we do it? We're like, well, we don't really know until we get there, you know, just like everybody else, everybody's getting mixed signals. But we have this one family that we're going to meet hopefully between today and tomorrow in Palisades, where they lived in a house that was very old. It was built probably in the 30s. And there was a bomb shelter in the backyard built into the ground. And so they were able to run some of their finest paintings into this bomb shelter, along with a photograph that was special to them and a bronze statue. And then they closed it up. So as they've been kind of scouring the area, trying to get in and close to where their house used to be, because it burned to the ground, they can still see the charred mound in the backyard. The bomb shelter is still there. They just don't know what's in it. And so Scott's going to be out there meeting with this family and is going to be uncovering, you know, hopefully getting in there and removing, with permission, of course, when they were allowed, removing, opening the vault, kind of like, you know, the Al Capone, Geraldo Rivera televised story about when they found
the, big reveal,
vault.
Right?
Yeah,
right.
Down in the basement, and it was live TV, and they opened it up and it was just nothing but crickets. There was nothing in there. But this family definitely knows that they put their family heirlooms in there. And of course, these paintings may not be worth anything to anyone else except for emotional value, because they are ancestors. And so, you know, it's just exciting things like that, just trying to find the story in all of it. There's history and everything that comes through us to the lab. And, you know, you just think about all of the souls that have been connected with the artwork. And it's really important. It's really powerful.
So a couple of things I want to mention to you, Gina. Here in Montecito, after the mudslide, I had an intrepid client who was, he was saying, I am going to just, I don't care who's guarding what, I'm getting into my house. And so he did. And we were, he asked our office to come and meet him. We had at that time a four-wheel drive vehicle, so we were able to get to where we needed to go. We met him there, kind of evaded the guards in the area, which I don't know why we did that, but we did for him. And, you know, the if you can picture, a normal door frame is 8 foot tall.
Yeah.
I'm 5'7". There was only 4 foot of opening left because there was that much mud. It was at least 4 feet of mud in throughout the whole house. And what was so interesting was he had a bomb shelter as well that he turned into a wine cellar.
Oh,
and he was so grateful because he was a collector of fine wine.
Yeah, nice.
He was so grateful that for that structure. And I was there too. And it's sort of like what you're narrating with Scott. We opened that structure and the wine was all there. What was the problem? Was that the wine labels, because of the moisture, were gone.
Oh my gosh.
So he had, you know,
so he had to try them all?
No, they were off. They were off the bottles. There was no way of identifying.
No, but I mean, that means you guys had to try the wine and see. Oh,
this is right. That would have been great.
This is a Meritage. Yes. This is a Chardonnay.
Right. Right. That would be great. That would be great. Richard, do we have to go to quick break? Okay. We're going to go to quick break. And I want to talk a little. I promised Gina I would tell her a little bit about how value is assessed for emotional damages, not by insurance companies, but in a court situation. It's different. Yeah. And it's a whole different standard in court. And I want to talk to Gina a little bit about that standard, because I found it really interesting these past 4 or 5 years where our office has been involved in fire damage expert witness cases.
Yeah.
And so that's been super interesting. Let's talk about that when we get back from the break, Gina. Don't turn that dial. Back in a minute with Gina Dillon. Welcome back. I'm speaking with Gina Dillon, who's the business administrator for the Fine Art Conservation Laboratories in Goleta. And we happened to be chatting, emailing, and I said, Gina, are you getting a lot of phone calls about insurance matters? And she said, oh my God, I can hardly keep up with it. And she's arranged for her boss, Scott Haskins, who's an expert master art restorer, to meet a bunch of people in the Palisades as we speak. And she was telling us, Richard, before the break, how interesting some family put their fine art into a World War II bomb shelter in the back of their property. And Scott is at this moment witnessing the opening of that bomb shelter to see what's made it through in that art. That art, how interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Interesting.
Yeah,
it's just that these claims that these people are dealing with, they're so emotionally charged, you know. And no, you're right, people don't trust. We were talking about certain groups of people in different, are very different in different areas, but a lot of times people don't trust, you know, public adjusters or restoration companies. And or lawyers, you know, of course, and sometimes these folks are in the wrong when it comes to monetary amounts, you know, that they think that they should be receiving. Sometimes they're wrong about that. But if you can, you know, include the emotional attachment, the documentation, you know, and all of that, if you're believable and you're likable in litigation, you know, then you might just get what you're asking for. But you can't put a dollar sign on a painting. That's why when people call, I mean, for a painting that's been painted by grandma, you know, that's why when people call, you know, I'm genuinely excited about listening to their stories. I mean, I can't spend too much time on the phone because then it would eat into my day, but just imagine getting calls every day of your life from people who are telling you stories that, you know, you could see on a Netflix special, you know, how this painting even got to America. I just got off the phone with a lady this morning who is a 4-foot by 6-foot painting that her grandmother painted of one of her ancestors as a little girl on the Mayflower. She has a 6-foot painting in her living room of this. It's not worth anything. It's old, you know, I don't know how, you know, it's 100 years old, but the story behind it is of another relative coming over as a little girl on the Mayflower. So it's like every day I hear stories like this, and you can't put a monetary value on that. But if you're going to fight an insurance company and you're going to lawyer up, you know, you better be prepared to tell people how important that piece is to you, where it came from, who it was painted by, anything you can get, you know? So, yeah, it's fascinating and heartbreaking at the same time.
So a couple of things that, you know, we were going to talk about some hands-on fixes that people can do right away. We talked a little bit, you know, saying, you know, get your inventory together. There's various apps for inventories. There's also, you know, the old fashioned way, which is to write things down, keep good files, et cetera. There's also a way to kind of research value on your own. And I wanted to mention a couple valuable websites that I use. Gina was saying, you know, that an object should have value by virtue of its narrative capacity, but it also should have value by virtue of its monetary value. Right. So talking about the emotional connection, which we did, you know, I suggested to do a video and narrate each piece that was, let's say, of value to you by virtue of money or by virtue of sentiment.
Right.
There's also some websites that folks can use, Gina, that they can actually do a little research on their own to find out if something is worth mentioning or even if something is worth pursuing, to schedule it on your insurance policy.
Yeah.
So before you actually, you know, say, okay, I need to schedule everything in the house that's over $1,000, what you can do is do a little preemptive research on your own. So these are the sites I use. I'll make a list for you. I use P4A, P the letter P, the number 4A. So it's Prices for Antiques, and that is a fantastic site for decorative art and for furniture and sometimes fine art. Do you have any sites you use, Gina?
No, I was just writing down the website that you that you gave me so that I could pass that on to clients, and you could share those with me in email. That would be great.
I will. So here's a couple more. So it's P4A.
Yep.
Ask Art. Ask Art is one word, like to ask, and then the second word, art. That website is fantastic for American art.
Yeah, I've used that one before for sure.
Ask Art. There's another one that's great for European works. It's based out of France. It's called Art Price.
Okay.
For contemporary art and art that's in galleries right now, so you have a gallery price, so you'll be able to look at retail prices offered. Mm-hmm. The other sites that I'm telling you about, Gina, they are not offered prices; they're consummated sales.
Okay, got you.
This site I'm going to give you right now is offered prices and sold prices. It's called Mutual Art. So this website reports on artworks that have sold, consummated prices paid, but they also carry dealers' offers to sell on that website.
That's good to know. I wish I would have known that 7 years ago.
Yeah. So Mutual Art, I really like. Now, many of these sites, you got to subscribe, but you can do like a month subscription sometimes. It's not as expensive. The absolute ultimate art collector's website is ArtNet.
ArtNet.
Like
okay.
a net.
Yeah, I've heard of that one.
ArtNet, a full service site for decorative art and fine art. They used to deal only with fine art, but now they also cover decorative art and furniture and sculpture. They're very good with that, and they're very good with photography as well.
Nice.
ArtNet. And then finally, WorthPoint and Invaluable. They're not my favorite, but they do more common objects.
Yeah.
Gina, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming along. And
thank you.
Me.
It was really
and
fun.
It was fun.
We'll do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Follow up. Okay. Bye, Gina. Thank you.
Thank you.